Good evening, friends. Wonderful to have such a full house. The Lucy Parsons Center welcomes you to this evening with Noam Chomsky, speaking on the subject, Bringing the Third World Home. Now, most of you know of Mr. Chomsky. That's why you are here. But perhaps you do not know about the Lucy Parsons Center. We are a bookstore and learning center. Formerly Red Book in Jamaica Plain, then on River Street in Cambridge, we are now in Central Square, Cambridge, on the Red Line between Kendall and Harvard Squares. You can spot us easily. We practically dominate the square with our huge sign and display windows, children's books in one window, books on topics of the day in the other. And of course, all these last few weeks, Mr. Chomsky's books have been displayed. We sell books in French, Spanish, even Creole. We are a collective run entirely by volunteers. The brochure you received at the door tells you about our 20-year history and our purpose for existing, which is to make progressive literature and other educational resources available in the Boston area. Please come and visit us. For the few of you who do not know of Mr. Chomsky's career, his writings, and honors, here are some highlights. He has 3 degrees in linguistics from the University of Pennsylvania, BA, MA, PhD. He lectures frequently and has been honored in this country and abroad. He has taught at MIT since 1955. He is a perceptive critic of the media and of American foreign and domestic policy. Mr. Chomsky, we are delighted to have you here this evening.
Is this the one for the auditorium? Yeah. Can you hear me through this one? Yeah. Trying to figure out if the mics are right. What? Can't hear. Up. Is it that I'm not speaking into it or what? Yeah. Are these going to be okay? They're awful low. They're all right? Yeah. Okay. I trust the techies over there. Well, I'd like to say a few things about where the country's going, or more accurately, where it's being driven by quite conscious and deliberate social policy. The policies that are being followed are strenuously opposed by a substantial majority of the population. That's demonstrated quite conclusively and unambiguously by regular polling. However, the policies are by and large supported by elite opinion. So what we read is that they're an expression of the public will. You constantly read that the contract with America is poll-driven, the result of careful soundings of public opinion, and so on and so forth. You have to get down to the footnotes to discover that even now, less than 40% of the population has even heard of it. And when they're asked about its specific terms, virtually without exception, they are overwhelmingly opposed. But that's, you know, just the facts. The preferred story is the kind of thing that you get, say, in last Sunday's Boston Globe from their business correspondent, David Warsh, who assures us that, I'll quote him, a great preponderance of Americans want a balanced budget, even with far-reaching cuts in spending for education and health. Well, there's a way to discover what a great preponderance of Americans want, and the way is to look at the very regular and extensive polling that's done to check the pulse of the country, mostly for business interests and for PR interests, but there's a lot of data on it. And people have been asked what they think about a balanced budget if it entails not far-reaching, but any cuts in education and social spending. When people are asked whether they want a balanced budget with accompanied by cuts in spending, 22% say yes. When they're asked do they want a balanced budget with cuts for health spending, 25% say yes, and similarly for other kinds of cuts. But as that's transmuted into a lead opinion, it becomes a great preponderance of the public wants a balanced budget even with far-reaching cuts in social spending, spending for education and health. Well, he gives evidence, not polls, but the evidence that he gives is that that's the proof is that that's what Congress is pushing. And since we live in a democracy, if Congress is pushing it, it's got to be what the great preponderance of the public wants. The Congress that he's talking about is one that is so comically subordinated to business rule that it doesn't even conduct the usual pretenses of concealing the fact that legislation is written by corporate lobbyists. In fact, it's been bringing the corporate lobbyists who write the legislation right into the press conferences to tell the press what's in the bills that they write instead of having them hide behind the curtains in the usual fashion. And this has been so transparent, it's become a joke in the Washington Press Corps. Even the New York Times has had stories about it. Well, that's reality again. This morning, the Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, Washington correspondent of the Boston Globe, David Shreveman, tells us of what he calls Newt Gingrich's contempt for the corporate lobbyists, that is, the ones he spreads the red carpet for so that they can appear and explain to the press the legislation that they wrote and tell the congressmen what they're signing. In general, without proceeding, there's a world and there's a picture of the world, and they may not necessarily have much to do with one another. If you want to see about the real world, there are places to look, too. A good place to look to see where the country's going is the issue of Fortune magazine that came out this week. It's a kind of a special issue. Every year, Fortune magazine comes out with a special issue on the Fortune 500, you know, the 500 richest corporations. This year, it's both industrial and what they call service corporations. Remember, service doesn't mean people who clean the floor and so on. It means insurance companies and investment banks and so on and so forth. So the top 500 industrial and service corporations, and this is an unusually fat issue because they're celebrating their 40th anniversary, so, you know, a lot of hoopla and so on, and also because they're so excited. They point out that the profits this last year, 1994, were up, they say, a stunning 54% over 93. And that's on virtually flat sales growth, 8% sales growth, and virtually no employment growth, 2.6% employment growth. The Fortune 500 controls 63% of gross domestic product, U.S. gross domestic product. And in addition, they control an unspecified amount of the world economy. Well, that's a degree of tyrannical control over the world that is rare and probably without any precedent in human history. And remember that the word tyrannical is exactly accurate. These are unaccountable totalitarian institutions run from top down, about which the public have nothing to say. So the more control they can be given over the decisions that affect ordinary life, the better things are, because the less danger there is that the great beast, as Alexander Hamilton once described you folks, that the great beast can get involved and disrupt things that are none of their business, like public affairs. Well, that's where the country's going. If you look more closely, you see even in greater detail where it's going. One of the biggest gainers last year was Manpower Incorporated, 35% increase in sales. Another one was Kelly, 21% increase in sales. Remember that these are the people who sell, as they put it, temporary employees. who are that increasing temporary employees is part of the strategy of devastating the workforce in the United States by undermining worker rights, benefits, the gains that have been won in a very long and hard struggle over well over 100 years. We just passed May Day, which everywhere outside the United States is the commemoration, is celebrated as a Labor Day in memory of the originally in support for the struggles of American workers for an eight-hour day. This is the one country where nobody even knows what it is. It's a day when you're supposed to wave flags, the president gave a patriotic speech, and so on and so forth. Labor Day in the United States is at the end of the summer. That is when you go back to work, you know, not when you worry about the days in Chicago when workers were getting killed because they were struggling for an eight-hour day and the rest of the world celebrates it, like Mexico and so on. Well, that's Kelly in Manpower. During this, all of this is part of the general process by which the United States is taking on, or is being driven more accurately, towards a kind of a third world character, pretty consciously, in fact quite consciously. A third world, typical third world country has a sector of extremely wealthy people, a big mass of people living in utter misery, and a large number of people who are basically superfluous. They're the ones you send the death squads out for, you do social cleansing or whatever. And that is the goal. The goal is to try to make the United States look like that. In fact, to try to make the world look like that. Makes a lot of sense if you happen to be within the sector that's going to become enriched by this process. While profits went up 54% last year, wages continued the decline. They've been declining since 1980. According to the latest figures, they've dropped over 7% since 1989, right through the Clinton recovery. That's unprecedented. For what they call unskilled workers, meaning people with a high school education, the wages have dropped somewhere between 20 and 25% since 1980. Those are the angry white males people read about, people whose lives are falling apart. Any hope for providing for families or having a decent wage in life is basically disappearing. The anger is perfectly understandable, if not the reactions. In fact, the reactions are understandable, too, in the absence of any organization or understanding or direction as to what a constructive way to respond might be. For college-educated people, wages did stay up until 1987. By then, the Reaganite changes had succeeded in hitting college-educated people, too, and wages started to decline for them in 1987, or continuing. That's the other side of the story. So profits booming, wages dropping. The facts are reported. It's not that they're a secret, especially in the business press. They're regularly reported. So in 1992, when the effect of the Reagan policies, actually Carter-Reagan policies, was already evident. The Wall Street Journal had a story in which they hailed what they called a welcome development of transcendent importance. The welcome development of transcendent importance was that in 1985, before the effect of these reforms had hit, the United States had the highest wages, technically highest labor costs per unit output, of any industrial country, which is pretty much what you'd expect. This is by far the richest country in the world. It's completely unparalleled advantages. But by 1992, it was the lowest in the industrial world, except for England, where Thatcher had done even a better job of smashing up poor and working people. Actually, in 1990, the United States actually went below England and was world champion, but then England fell even further. So the welcome development of transcendent importance is we were now had the lowest labor costs in the industrial world next to Thatcher. And the end of the Cold War was hailed in the business press precisely, largely because it provided weapons to extend and accelerate this process. And that was pretty explicit. So the London Financial Times, which is the main international business journal, ran a story on Poland called, with the headline, Green Shoots in Communism's Ruins. Communism, you know, everything's a horrible wreck and so on and so forth. Communism destroyed everything, but there are some green shoots. Some good things are happening. The green shoots were that thanks to the, as they put it, thanks to the capitalist reforms, the pauperization and unemployment of the workforce has reached such a high level that now Western corporations can move there and get workers for 10% of what they called the pampered Western workers. And Business Week chimed in and warned the pampered Western workers that they were going to have to abandon their luxurious lifestyles before GM could only move to, say, Mexico or, you know, Brazil or Indonesia. But now they can even move to East Europe, where, incidentally, they get demand and receive high tariff protection and subsidies and so on under the usual free market doctrines, which mean, you know, for thee, but not for me. That's what it's meant for a couple hundred years. So it's reported all right. It's reported with great glee. And indeed, it sort of tells you what the Cold War was about. Just take a look at who's cheering and who's complaining, and you learn quite a lot about what it was about. Incidentally, among those who are cheering, the former rulers of the communist countries, communist party hierarchy, who are now that it's being driven back to the third world, they are the wealthy sector, the super rich sector, which beyond their wildest dreams, cooperating with Western capital, while the country sinks into ruin. So they're among the victors of the Cold War, the people in Eastern Europe and the people in the West. The formerly pampered Western workers are the losers. Well, all of this is expected to continue. It's not over. Fortune, last issue before this one, had an article headlined, Why Profits Will Keep Booming. 1993 was described as a dazzling year for profits with virtually stagnant sales growth. 1994, as just said, was, as they put it here, even more splendid. That's the fourth straight year of double-digit profits, quite a profit growth, not profits, of double-digit profit growth, which is pretty extremely unusual, and they expect it to continue for another couple of years at least. Earnings per share have doubled since 1991. The return on capital has more than doubled since 1980, and other things are rising too, they didn't talk about it, along with profits. Working hours are going up, the number of percentage of temporary employees is going up, jails are going way up, jail population more than tripled in the 1980s and still increasing and expected to increase further. The level of starvation is increasing nicely, mainly among children and elderly people. But also others. People without medical insurance is going up. The disintegration of families is improving, more and more of that, a result of the 15-year war, which is what it is, against families and children and women that has been conducted under the banner of family values. It takes a really properly functioning propaganda system to get away with that one. There are also some things that are going down. Wages are going down. The trickle of welfare for the poor, which is all it ever was, we have a very miserly welfare system by world standards, that's been going down. AFDC, the one everyone talks about, aid for families with dependent children, that's dropped around 50% in real terms since mid-1970s, and several years after the decline in these funding for families, poor families, you can see the disintegration setting in. There's a cause and effect relation, though just the opposite of the one that's usually claimed, and for obvious reasons. Taxes for the rich are going down, way down. Labor costs are going down, as I mentioned. They have now reached the lowest level since 1981. That's the welcome development of transcendent importance. So the right things are going up and the right things are going down. From the point of view of the masters, the people who own and run things. So what should be done in the face of these catastrophic consequences for the general population, catastrophic consequences of contemporary state capitalism? Well, that's explained too. So the New York Times last week had a front page story on it. with a headline reading, "New York is simply not wealthy enough to afford services to the general public." They're really in trouble. The source for this information is an expert to whom they turned. The expert is a J.P. Morgan executive. J.P. Morgan ranks fifth among American banks in the Fortune 500. It's part of the sector of the country that has money coming out of its ears. The country is absolutely awash in capital. All the talk about lean and mean times and so on is complete nonsense. Corporations don't know what to do with the capital that's flooding through them. So J.P. Morgan executive explains that New York is just not wealthy enough to offer services to poor people, and there's a solution, the Times goes on to explain. The solution is to cut taxes, but that means cut taxes for the rich. Again, you sort of look down on a continuation page in the inside section, and you notice that all the taxes, without exception, are for the benefit of business. And while you're cutting taxes for the rich, what you do is increase taxes for everyone else, except, and here comes some free advice for those of you who are hoping to make it into elite circles, you don't call them taxes. You have a different name for them. What you call them is, to quote the New York Times, multi-million dollar reductions in subsidies for the city's mass transit system and in aid to education and higher education. Notice that these are subsidies, like if taxpayers in New York use their funds to pay to have transportation, that's a subsidy by definition, sort of illegitimate. So you cut down those subsidies to mass transportation like subways and education and higher education, which is precisely equivalent to taxes. Somebody's going to pay, except highly regressive taxes. Cut down, you know, funding for taxpayer money that goes to the subways, and the subway fares go up. Cut down funding for city college and community colleges, and the costs go up. And somebody pays those costs to the city, meaning a tax, namely poor people. It's tax, but a highly regressive tax, not a tax on the guys who drive their limousines through the streets, you know, to LaGuardia Airport, where plenty of subsidies keep going, because you have to make sure that the jet planes keep flying overseas and so on, plenty of subsidies for that one. But subsidies for the subways, money for the subways, that goes down, and for higher education goes down. So we have taxes, but we don't call them taxes. And that's pretty general. If you think through look at the whole array of fiscal measures, and you see that taxes are going down for the rich and going up for the poor. So it was already a pretty regressive system, and it's got to become even more regressive. The mayor of New York finally came clean and said what everybody could see was happening. Mayor Giuliani, he said the idea is to drive the poor people out of the city, that they don't belong there. You know, it's not their place. New York City is for the meritocracy, for people like the J.P. Morgan executive who says they don't have enough money for services for the poor, only services for the rich. Of course, there are people who have to do the dirty work, but they can live in favelas, as they'd be called if they were in Brazil, you know, miserable suburbs around the edge where they can sort of find their way into work somehow to clean the streets and, you know, do the laundry and whatever has to be done. But meanwhile, New York will be for the meritocracy, the guys with the good salaries. So therefore, the policies are, as Giuliani and the Times explain, to deprive people of rent, of heating, of money for heating their houses, for food, transport, home care for the disabled and elderly and so on, just cut all that stuff. And then they can just go somewhere else if they can find somewhere else to go. The headline for all of this reads as follows: welfare cuts provide a chance to move. Okay? So in other words, the poor are no longer trapped by welfare dependency, thanks to their liberator, who they now have a chance to move. The compassion really brings tears to the eyes. There's a technical name for this. It's called tough love, which is sort of appropriate. It means love for the rich and tough for everybody else. Another term for that is the free market, you know, which means plenty of protection for us, but you guys accept market discipline. And all of this passes without any, well, I wouldn't say with no comment, it passes with some comment. So here's an example of the comment. That's New York. They get tough love, poor people in New York. What about, to go to the other extreme, say Cobb County, Georgia, interesting place, represented by Newt Gingrich. So there's no tough love for Cobb County, Georgia, not at all. Well, maybe there shouldn't be. If you read, again, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent of the Boston Globe, David Shreveman, he explains that Gingrich is really a pretty nice guy. He's not like these bad guys who think we ought to get rid of government and so on. Gingrich, he says, is the nation's leading champion of independence and of the solitary entrepreneur. Okay, that's Newt Gingrich, in case you didn't notice. And Shreveman points out that Gingrich would be quite happy to, he's not one of these guys who just wants to destroy the government. You know, he's not a crazy, doesn't love federal buildings. In fact, he'd be very happy to have a government. He'd even take government funds, Shreveman explains, and he would use them for laptops for the poor. He wouldn't use them for rich people because he's a real populist type, but he would use them for laptops for the poor. Well, as I said, Newt Gingrich is the representative of Cobb County, Georgia, so we can check how many laptops there are for the poor there. Actually, the percentage of poor people there who have laptops is probably quite high because poor people can't get into Cobb County. It's what he calls a Norman Rockwell world of jet planes and fiber optics, which is pretty correct. And all you have to do is ask where jet planes and fiber optics come from. And the answer to that is, well, they come out of taxpayer funding. That's why Cobb County is very wealthy. One of the reasons, not the only reason. Another reason, it's a suburb of Atlanta, which is a pretty wealthy city. And it's a very wealthy city because of enormous federal funding, which is poured into Atlanta to make it a big, you know, transport hub with, you know, center for Delta Airlines, one of the biggest air traffic centers in the world, in fact, huge federally funded, meaning taxpayer-funded highways leading to Cobb County, but barriers to make sure that the wrong people don't get in. It's a very racist county, everyone concedes that. And in fact, Cobb County gets more federal subsidies than any suburban county in the country, with two exceptions, two interesting exceptions. One is Arlington, Virginia, which is part of Washington, D.C., that's part of the federal government itself, and the other is, like it's where the Pentagon is and that sort of thing, the other is Brevard County, Florida, which was set up during the Kennedy administration as another cash cow for the rich. That's the home of the Space Center, which is another one of those techniques by which the taxpayer funds rich people. That's one of the funnels for taxpayer funding of high technology industry. So with the exception of, and that's basically part of the federal system, you move out of the federal system itself and you discover that Newt Gingrich, the leading champion of independence and the solitary entrepreneur, happens to have managed to receive more federal subsidies than anybody else, extorting money from the taxpayer, as he puts it, his words, when somebody else is trying to get their hands on it. Well, the biggest solitary entrepreneur in Cobb County is Lockheed Martin, very high up on the, that's the highest employer, way high up in Fortune 500. That's a recent merger of two major taxpayer-funded corporations. I mean, they're private in the sense that the profit is private, but they're public in the sense that the payment is public. It's known as conservatism, that sort of thing. They were merged recently. Lockheed and Martin Marietta were merged into an even bigger corporation. And in order to help expedite the merger, the Clinton administration gave them an extra $1 billion of taxpayer funding. And then to kind of sweeten the pain for the, you know, executives who were involved in the merger, they gave them $30 million in an extra subsidy, including $8 million for the new CEO. Now, they were feeling, you know, kind of tough to undergo this merger, so you need a little bit of love, taxpayer love on the side. They are now the intended recipients of $72 billion, the new merged corporation, in funds, taxpayer funds, to construct the new F-22 stealth jet fighter bomber by Lockheed, and we need it. It's explained that we need it because Lockheed tells us that, as they put it, it's a dangerous world in which sophisticated fighter planes are being sold elsewhere, and therefore we need the F-22 to defend ourselves. Well, who is selling those sophisticated fighter planes elsewhere? Well, Lockheed. Here's the way I'm continuing. This is just reading Lockheed propaganda, you know, like Lockheed brochures. I'm not making this up. Lockheed explains, dangerous world, sophisticated fighters out there. We've sold, they continue, we have sold F-16s all over the world. And what if a friend or an ally turns against us? Okay. The United States, in fact, now sells approximately 3/4 of the arms to the third world. Maybe that's taxpayer-driven again, you know, because of the populist character of Congress. In this case, 90% of the population, 96% of the population is opposed to it. So it does have a bit of support in there, if you look carefully. Over the objection of 96% of the population, we're supplying 3/4 of the world, third world armed market, and you never know, these guys might turn against you sometime. Official U.S. defense, what they call defense posture, is that we have to maintain the Pentagon at basically Cold War levels because of the growing technological sophistication of third world powers. And to fend off that threat, which we are busily creating as much as we can, we have to not only put $72 billion into the pockets of Newt Gingrich's constituents and the others who work for them, but we also have to, taxpayers also have to upgrade the F-16s to make them more dangerous. So other Pentagon funding is going into upgrading the F-16s, which are being what's called sold to third world countries. Sold means basically given with export-import bank loans that the taxpayer again pays for. And in order to defend ourselves from this great threat that's growing, this technological sophistication, we've got to build the F-22. Well, that's the nation's leading champion of independence and the solitary entrepreneur. The Air Force Director of Science and Technology, General Richard Paul, explained that all of this is going to enhance our economic security by spinning off dual-use technology. That means that the taxpayer is paying Lockheed Marietta, but the point is for the money to go into what's called civilian production. Then, you know, others can sell computers and electronics and avionics, and, you know, Boeing can get its next plane into the skies as just advertising, thanks to taxpayer funding and huge profits for the private entrepreneurs and the deeply conservative spirits who are want to make sure that nobody's extorting any money from the taxpayer. Well, that's the way it works. Welfare for corporate America, way beyond what anybody calls corporate welfare. This is the real stuff. And it's corporate America, as General Paul says, is going to transition our work, meaning they'll take care of carrying out this policy of using taxpayer funds to build the F-22 with dual-use technology, meaning the rest of the Fortune 500 can milk the taxpayer, too, to keep those profits high. That's the main reason why the Pentagon is staying at Cold War levels. It's now, in real terms, actually above the spending of the Nixon years and roughly 85% of the Cold War average, which incidentally gives you a pretty good measure of how seriously they took the Russian threat, if you think it through. But there is a point, I mean, there is, of course, the need to keep the world under control, but the main point is to ensure that the rich keep wealthy, thanks to taxpayer funding. That's why the Heritage Foundation, you know, real conservative foundation, which is planning the big budget cuts, wants Pentagon funding to go up. And that's why in the Pentagon budget that was in the balanced budget proposal that just was ran through the House, if you have a look, you'll find the Pentagon funding does not, that's one thing that doesn't get cut, because you can cut money for starving children, but not for Newt Gingrich's constituents, please. They have to feel good and conservative and independent, and, you know, their entrepreneurial values have to be maintained by making sure that plenty of taxpayer funds go into their pockets. Well, that's the free market. The money that goes to Cobb County and other super rich folk, that's not subsidies. That's not like money that's going to mass transit in New York. In fact, that's security. And that framework, you know, not subsidy but security, that was established very explicitly, perfectly publicly. You don't have to go to secret documents to find it out, in the late 1940s. The first Secretary of the Air Force, Stuart Symington, good liberal, incidentally, when he became a senator, he's usually called a senator from Boeing. Stuart Symington and he explained that his job as Air Force Secretary was to make sure that Boeing, the biggest of the publicly subsidized private profit corporations, that Boeing gets the proper share of military procurement with dual-use technology, so it can then become the country's leading exporter, which it is. You know. And therefore, when Bill Clinton went to Seattle, Washington, for the APEC conference, Asia-Pacific Economic Conference, back in 1992, he gave a speech in which he presented what the press called his grand vision of the free market future, and he gave it in a hangar of the Boeing Corporation, pointing to Boeing as his model for the grand vision of the free market future, and that's quite accurate. The free market future is the public pays and the rich profit. It was so transparent, it takes a really good education to miss it, and you have to, people say the educational system's in trouble in the United States. But, you know, there's overwhelming evidence that that's false. The Harvard education is as good as it ever was, and the New York Times and everybody else didn't bat an eyelash when Clinton presented his vision of the free market future in the hangar of the Boeing Corporation to a cheering crowd, noting that they're the biggest civilian exporter thanks to dual-use technology, just as nobody respectable at least laughs when Newt Gingrich is described as the leading champion of independence and the solitary entrepreneur, just dying to get his hands on a little federal funds to give laptop computers to the poor. So a real populist. Well, that's Symington, when he was Secretary of State, Secretary of Air Force, first Secretary of the Air Force, this is 1948, he pointed out that, as he put it, the word to use is not subsidy. The word to use is security. That's the way we'll get the public to pay the subsidies for industry. And it was well understood at the time, again, no secret, all over the business press, that the industrial system, the private profit, privately run industrial system, cannot survive, as they put it, in an unsubsidized, competitive, free enterprise economy, and therefore the government must be the savior, as Business Week put it, and if government spending continues, it'll be the meaning through the military, because they immediately turn to that for a pretty clear and well-explained reasons, that'll be the formula for endless good times. That's the free enterprise system that you're supposed to extol, and that system has to not only remain intact but even grow while the little trickle of, sort of food for school children that is cut off because, like New York, the rest of the country just isn't wealthy enough to afford services to the poor, only services to the rich, for which we're always more than wealthy enough, as the Fortune 500 issue describes very accurately. Well, that's tough love, that's free markets, that's what they've been all through their history. There's no time to go through it, but if you go through the history of free market ideology and of development, way back to the British, then us, then the rest of the countries, always been the same thing, double-edged, always. Plenty of protection for me if I'm rich and powerful, plenty of state subsidy, but market discipline for you. You go back to the 18th century, and what is now the First World and what is now the Third World were not very different. In fact, in India, for example, the steel technology in India was more advanced than in England. The British were still sending engineers to India into the 1820s to learn techniques of making steel. They had cotton, textiles. Egypt was starting an industrial revolution. There's a lot of, you know, there's no simple reason for the tremendous difference between the first and the third world today, but one leading difference, surely, simply is that as a result of violence, colonization, and power, Britain, later the United States, later the other European countries, and later Japan, were able to not play games with free market ideology, but to resort to ample protection and subsidy, while the third world was compelled, and it rammed down their throat, to follow what is now called structural adjustment, neoliberalism, free market ideology. Major reason for the radical difference, and exactly the same thing is now happening at home. Subsidies and protection for the rich, free market discipline for, you know, children with, for poor children. Tough love, in other words, just bringing it home. If you look at what's going on, say, in Washington, it illustrates this historical pattern, which is now hundreds of years old. It illustrates it in fine detail, you know, to just perfection when you look closely. So take, say, the congressional debate a couple months ago over school budget, over school lunches. You recall that they were talking about cutting $6 or $7 billion a year from school lunches for school children. In the midst of that debate, one representative, David Hobie, I think of Michigan, introduced an amendment. He proposed that they keep the $6 or $7 billion for school lunches and pay for it by delaying for 5 years the deployment of F-22s, not cutting back the subsidy, but just delaying it a little bit, stretching it out. Well, Newt Gingrich, the champion of independence and solitary entrepreneurship, he took care of that proposal by not even letting it come to a vote. It was so ridiculous, because the solitary entrepreneurs, standing in their glorious conservatism, they need that $72 billion tomorrow, not spread out over 5 years. And if children have to go to school hungry, well, you know, just, or maybe not go to school, just too bad. That illustrates dramatically exactly what's going on everywhere, and indeed so does everything else. Take, say, deregulation. Deregulation is a huge gift to the Fortune 500 and corporate America generally. It means they're free to do anything they like. But remember, this is free market in the traditional sense, meaning free market with a security blanket. Deregulation, but a guarantee that if anything goes wrong, the public bails you out. That's part of the contract, which isn't right up front, but happens all the time. In fact, we saw a dramatic example of it right here in New England, right at the peak of the discussion of the debate over deregulation. Notice the way the deregulation is being done. It's not specific regulations that are being dropped. This is an across-the-board phenomenon. The idea is to make regulation impossible. The technique for making it impossible is to impose cost-benefit analysis, meaning if somebody proposes a regulation, they've got to demonstrate that the economic costs don't outweigh the gains. Well, any economist or scientist can tell you right off that that's a complete impossibility. A corporate lawyer who has even half of his brain functioning can drag out those discussions for 20 years, you know. There's no way to get those calculations. They don't even mean anything. So that essentially dismantles the whole apparatus. Right in the middle of all of this, while it was being rammed through Congress, the Maritime and Fisheries Administration closed down most of Georges Bank, the big fishing grounds off Cape Cod. That's one of the richest, maybe the richest fishing areas in the world, now mostly closed. The closing was extended again and is now for the indefinite future. Why did they have to close down the richest fishing area in the world? Well, during the Reagan years, free market policies were followed in the usual fashion. Meaning they deregulated fishing and subsidized the fishing industry. Well, the combination of deregulation and subsidy has pretty predictable effects. They just fished out all the groundfish, so now it's destroyed. Will it recover? Well, nobody knows. Cape Cod is now importing cod from Norway. where they have what's called a different philosophy, as they put it when this was described. Namely, they regulated their fishing grounds, so they still have some fish. Well, remember, this is our sense of free market, and we have a conservative governor here, Governor Weld. So Governor Weld quickly went hat in hand to Washington to ask the public to bail us out, to bail out the fishing industry from the combination of subsidy and deregulation. He went and asked for George's Bank to be declared a national disaster, which means the public has to pay for it. Why is it a national disaster? Well, a natural disaster, sorry. It's a natural disaster. It had nothing to do with deregulation and overfishing. Rather, he got some guys, I suppose, called scientists, although most everybody laughed about it, to go and claim that there's some strange form of predatory fish had come, previously unknown and for the moment invisible. And the predatory fish had wiped out the ground fish, you know, the ground fish and the cod and so on, and George's Bank, so it's like a natural disaster. What can we do? And therefore, the public has to come in and pay for it. That's standard free market techniques. The saving and loans institution were a perfectly simple example early in the Reagan years. And here it's both the Democrats and the Republicans. This isn't on party lines. The SNLs were deregulated, but granted more insurance. So, you know, the idea is make the worst loans, most risky loans you like, we're going to insure you anyway. And then when it all collapsed, as it did pretty soon, the public is called upon to pay it off, free market. We just saw the same thing in Mexico with the Goldman Sachs bailout. That Mexico was going to collapse was completely obvious to anybody outside the World Bank, I suppose. The thing was built on sand, it was completely transparent, everybody knew it. Only question was when, and when it collapsed, we get, you know, $40-50 billion of taxpayer funds to pay off the investors and make sure that they don't suffer too much and that their spirits stay up and, you know, tough love as usual. During the Reagan years, the biggest nationalization in American history was carried out, the nationalization of Continental Illinois Bank, when it, as a result of deregulation, got into trouble, so the public moves in and bails it out. In fact, during the Reagan years, you really saw, you know, tough love and free market ideology almost to perfection. It's pretty typical over the years that free market rhetoric escalates while protection goes up along with it for the rich. And that happened during the Reagan years, you know, odes to the free market and, you know, neoliberalism and, you know, entrepreneurial values and so on. Meanwhile, when they were talking to the business community, they talked a different line. That was to the public. But when Secretary of Treasury James Baker spoke to the business community, he took credit for the fact that, as he put it, the Reagan administration had given the business community here more protection than any post-war president, which is true, but overly modest. It was actually more than all post-war presidents combined. They had essentially doubled protection by either tariffs or non-tariff barriers up to about 23%, doubling it from about 12%, which is where it was when they came in. So along with creating huge debt and, they also virtually doubled protection, which had its effects. If they hadn't done it, if the United States had played the kind of free market games we impose on others, or the kind that are now imposed on the poor and the general population, we wouldn't have a steel industry, we wouldn't have a computer industry, we wouldn't have an automobile industry, no chips, no nothing. As throughout our history, we relied on the powerful weapon of protection and state subsidy to maintain a private power, private profit economy, and there's no other way to do it. And so it goes down the line. Another process underway in Washington is to dismantle the legal system. There are many aspects of this, and they're really worth looking at. One of them, in fact, is being a petition, I think, is going on around about it. One crucial part of the dismantling of the legal system is the elimination of the right of compensation for corporate crime. Now, that's kind of important. When a corporation likes to take a classic case, Johns Manville, conceals for decades the fact that it knowingly conceals for decades the fact that it's poisoning people by production of asbestos, there had been recourse. Plenty of people died, you know, nobody knows how many were sick and so on, but ultimately, after several decades, it was possible to go through the courts and ask for compensation. And that's got to be cut out. These solitary entrepreneurs who are being amply fed by the public, they have to have the right of defense from any kind of crime that they conduct. So the next Johns Manville, you got to make sure that nobody sues them, so that there are no constraints on corporate crime. That has to be made free, you know, free society after all. There's a reason why Philip Morris is the leading industrial funder for the new Gingrich army. They are the leading corporate killer, and therefore they need to make sure that they are protected from any crime. Tobacco is, I'm sure you know, one of the most lethal drugs around. It's killing plenty of people here, but that's not enough. People here, you know, there's some reduction in smoking. So not only Philip Morris, but the other major corporations have turned to the nanny state, as usual, to use its power to force open other markets. So right at the same time that George Bush announced the famous drug war and, you know, warned about how we have to, you know, protect ourselves from Colombian and, at that time, Panamanian narco traffickers, preparation for invading Panama. Same time, you know, within days, the U.S. Trade Representative announced that the U.S. was hearings, which led to the threat of sanctions against Thailand for trying to protect itself against U.S. lethal drugs, namely tobacco. The markets in Japan and Korea had already been forced open by the threat of sanctions, and now Thailand had to be open so we could kill plenty of people there. And the purpose was made very explicit. It was to improve the trade balance. About all we can sell these people is lethal narcotics, so therefore we got to make sure that they have no barriers to import of lethal narcotics or of advertising for them. I mean, it's as if the Medellin cartel was powerful enough to force us to permit advertising aimed at children and women, which is what the advertising is, to use more and more cocaine. And if we didn't do it, they'd threaten us with trade sanctions. Well, of course, that's a joke, because we're the big guy. Other than that, the logic is identical. So under the threat of trade sanctions, Asian countries have to accept lethal drugs from the United States, highly lethal drugs, way worse in terms of their consequences than hard drugs. They have to accept not only the drugs, but even advertising for them, aggressive advertising aimed primarily at the new markets, the opening new markets, women and youth. And indeed, as soon as they agreed, you know, you do what the boss tells you, when they did open the markets, there had been a decline in smoking, meaning in deaths from smoking, and that shifted instantly. In each country, as soon as the markets were open and the advertising was open to the American multinationals, smoking, which had been going down, started going up. And within a couple of years, when the statistics come in, you'll see the deaths going up as well. One estimate by an Oxford University epidemiologist is that in China, kids under 20 now, about 50 million will die of tobacco-related diseases. That's a pretty impressive toll, even by 20th century standards. And you need state power to ram through consequences like that, because you have to make sure that nobody defends themselves from aggressive advertising aimed at improving our trade balance, not for American workers, but for corporations making profit so they can stay way high up in Fortune 500. Take the matter of democracy. That's also under severe attack, and it's by now kind of irrelevant. As I mentioned, the population strongly opposes just about every element of the contract and the rest of the policies going through, but it doesn't make any difference. Civil society's been pretty much eroded. People are isolated. They may be desperate and angry and so on, but they don't have anything to do about it. There is a traditional method for poor people to get together and try to protect their rights and increase democratic rights and so on. That's unions. There's others, but that's a major one, the major one, in fact, in modern industrial society. That's why unions are under tremendous attack. There's a major strike going on right now in Decatur, Illinois. It's the most important labor conflict in the United States since the 1930s. The three major corporations, one owned by British Transnational, one Bridge on Firestone, another one, Caterpillar, are trying to destroy the last major industrial unions in a good old, in an old working class town. And they've already succeeded with one. Last week, the United Rubber Workers capitulated because they could not deal with what's called permanent replacement workers, scabs in English, who were brought in to destroy the strike. Well, that's illegal, at least it's in violation of international labor standards. The United States has already been condemned by the International Labor Organization for allowing the resort to scabs, to brick strikes. At the time that the ILO made this ruling in 1992, there were two countries, industrial countries, that were in violation of these standards, United States and South Africa. South Africa has defected from the cause, and now the United States is in splendid isolation in violation of international labor standards on this issue. It also has the worst record in Europe or the Western Hemisphere in observing international standards, with two exceptions, Lithuania and El Salvador are a little bit worse. But apart from that, we're worse. But that's not going to be a problem pretty soon, in case you're worried. Jesse Helms announced that the new Foreign Relations Act will, under it, the United States will withdraw from the ILO. So it won't matter that we're in violation of international labor standards on this and other issues. The United Rubber Workers capitulated. The remaining workers are going on a hunger strike in a couple of days, or maybe have already started. Hope, with church support and public support, trying to get some kind of national attention and domestic attention. It's not going to be easy. They don't have any resources. The press won't cover it. If you're not right in Decatur, Illinois, or you happen to be on one of the nets that knows about it, you won't know. End result is people are angry, desperate, hopeless, alone, don't see any constructive way to respond to what's going on about them. You end up with a pretty ominous prospect. Well, to see how far all of this has gone, take a look at the Wall Street Journal, which either yesterday or the day before had a story with the following headline. It said, "Republicans take aim at left-leaning groups that get federal grants for assistance programs. Then it explained how they're going to try to defund the left-wing groups that are getting federal funding. The top left-wing group, then you look at the list, the top one that is Catholic Charities. That's the top left-wing group that has to be defunded, and the reason is that nuns and priests, this explained, are running programs for low-income heating and a head start. So therefore they have to be defunded because they're dangerous lefties. The second left-wing group that has to be defunded is the American Association of Retired People, the AARP, and the reason is that they're running programs to help elderly Americans get jobs. An earlier Wall Street Journal story pointed out that 16% of the elderly are starving, but you want to make sure that the left-wing dangerous radicals, the AARP, aren't getting any funding to help them get jobs. And it goes on like that. Without comment, nobody's going to write a letter, yeah? I mean, the spectrum is such that Catholic Charities and the AARP are now way off on the left, and we got to stop that business. Actually, it's rather flattering to the left, I should say. It means anybody who has any concern for human beings is defined as the left. And then, on the other side, we have the defenders of entrepreneurial values and so on. Well, it's obviously important to protect people in the United States from left-wing propaganda, so therefore you can understand why the press, as far as I know, uniformly, has suppressed the results of the Latin American Bishops Council. Remember, that's the top of the left-wing organizations. They meet regularly in Latin America. They just had their last meeting on May 1st. The Latin American Bishops Council met, and they, quoting from the National Catholic Reporter, issued scathing condemnations of neoliberal capitalism and the United States and the drug trade, which they say is sponsored by neoliberal capitalism in the United States. Here's what the new elected president of the Latin American bishop says, Archbishop of Tegucigalpa, Honduras. He says, neoliberal capitalism carries injustice and inequality in its genetic code. In the concluding statement, the Latin American bishops, the 70 bishops around Latin America, said they made a judgment against neoliberal capitalism, you know, what we call free market, meaning double-edged free market, which they said has caused the impoverishment and misery of millions of Latin Americans. They proposed an economy at the service of humankind rather than at the service of groups of powerful people, and they called for a regional solidarity to overcome the economic, social, corruption, narco-trafficking, and migration problems which neoliberalism has caused. The Archbishop of Venezuela said that the bugaboo for many years was communism, but which is worse, communism or these neoliberal bandits without conscience who have the dollar as their god? That's us, incidentally. And they go on and on with that. Well, you know, it's kind of important that it's not the right sort of thing for American ears, so you can understand why all of this stuff is suppressed, just as Catholic Charities has to be defunded as a left-wing group. And indeed, all the Latin American bishops' congresses are always suppressed. I have never seen any reference to any one of them anywhere near the time when it took place. Well, these things are not laws of nature, the things that are going on. These are human decisions, you know, made in human institutions. They're not graven in stone. Corporate tyranny, for example, is pretty recent in its modern form. It goes back to the early part of this century. Actually, if you look at it, it grows from the same intellectual soil as the other two major forms of modern totalitarianism, namely Bolshevism and fascism. They come from the same, pretty much the same roots. Two have gone. One is greater in strength and power than ever. But it's no more, you know, immutable than the other companion forms of tyranny and totalitarianism were. It's never been easy to try to defend or extend the range of freedom and justice. Now it's mostly a matter of defending it. It's never been impossible either. It's not certainly not easy now, but it's also not impossible. And I think there's rarely been a moment in history when the choice as to whether to do so has carried such enormous human consequences. Thanks. Mic up there if anybody wants to talk. It's down the middle aisle for anybody's interest.
A couple weeks ago in Amherst, Mass., you responded to a question about the 25 most censored stories, indicating that we're not exactly pleased with the process of how they choose those stories. You indicated at that time that stories that you had submitted were not accepted. Can you give us an idea of two or three of the stories you've submitted in the last couple of years for the 25 most censored stories?
Well, you know, Rogers, there is this project that he was talking about called Most Censored Stories, which comes out of one of the California State Universities. Pardon? Sonoma State, yeah. Carl Jensen, professor of communications there, has been running it. It's been a useful project. I'm sort of glad it exists. I've been on the panel, but I've objected to almost everything they've done. That's what I was saying. I'm always in a minority of almost one on the panel. And but I stay on, I don't know for how long, because it's sort of good to have it around. I just have a very different judgment than most of the other people. I have submitted plenty of stories. I'd have to, you know, check back my correspondence to see exactly what they were. But they were things like, for example, the Bishop's Council. I mean, that's a typical story that I would suggest, you know, that ought to be covered. Or, for example, the George's Bank story. That's one that I would suggest. Over the years, I've suggested plenty of stories on international affairs. So, for example, I don't even try to submit them anymore because I know it's not going to work. But I would have submitted for last year what I think is one of the biggest stories of the year, to my amazement, almost totally suppressed. I wrote about it at once, but I write for a journal where it's going to come out 6 weeks later, so I wrote as if everybody knew about it already. This was the story that didn't come out the day before the day of the sending of U.S. troops to Haiti. The day that was Monday, if you recall, that U.S. troops went into Haiti to defend democracy. On Sunday, the day before, I happened to be monitoring the AP wires because sort of interested, you know, it's obvious something's going on. And if you ever look at AP wires, you know, a ton of stuff pours out, but they pick stories that are the big stories. You know, they focus your attention on the big ones. And the big story that they were running that day was that they had a leak from the Justice Department pointing out that, who were apparently sick of what was going on, from somebody in the Justice Department giving them evidence on the fact that the Bush and Clinton administrations had authorized the shipment of oil to the military junta and its supporters right through the whole period of the embargo. Well, in a way, it wasn't a big surprise. If you'd been watching Haiti, you knew that oil was getting through because, you know, the biggest, the richest family there, the Mevs family, which was supporting the coup, was building a big tank farm, and they weren't doing it for milk, you know. So oil was somehow getting through, but it turns out it was authorized by the Bush and the Clinton administrations. That is, they informed Texaco that it was illegal, but they also told them they weren't going to prosecute it. And then when Texaco went to the Justice Department and proposed a scam by which they could, you know, a fake corporation that they could set up as a cover to send the oil, the Justice Department gave them a ruling saying that's illegal, but don't worry about it, we're not going to do anything. And this went right on through the Clinton administration. In other words, there never was an embargo. It was like tough love again. There was an embargo for poor people, but no embargo for rich people. So therefore, we had to move in to defend democracy and, you know, restore President Aristide, but with a you know, kind of a noose around his neck, making him follow a World Bank written economic proposal, which states, here's another thing I would have added, that the international funding that's coming into Haiti has to be used for, I'm quoting it now virtually, Haitian civil society, primarily the business community and foreign investors. So U.S. investors are part of civil society, but not those peasants in the hills in Haiti. Well, you know, when this appeared, I was certain, I mean, maybe, I figured maybe they'll miss it on Monday, but on Tuesday it's got to be the biggest story of the week. You know, Haitian, American troops coming in was the biggest story, so nothing happened. So I wrote an article that's going to come out in Z Magazine like 6 weeks later. So I wrote it in past tense, you know, saying, well, yeah, as you all know. Well, Monday nothing came out. Tuesday something did come out. We have a free press. I finally did a data search, you know, a Nexus search on this. I had a friend in the library do it. I'm a Luddite. I don't know how to do it, but somebody did it for me. And it turns out on Tuesday there was a story in Platts Oilgram, which is a professional journal of the oil industry. On Wednesday, there were about 10 lines hidden in the Wall Street Journal and a couple of stories, small stories in newspapers around the country, you know, like Akron, Ohio, and stuff, places where editors aren't clever enough to know what's supposed to be totally suppressed. It still hasn't made the New York Times or the Washington Post, or as far as I recall, the Boston Globe, or most of the major newspapers. Well, you know, that's the kind of story that I would have given them. And same things on the so-called peace process in the Middle East and, you know, the undermining of the Central American Accords and just story after story, which nobody else in the panel thinks are interesting, apparently, because they never get in there. But those are typical examples.
Yes. I was curious if you knew about the views expressed by Dr. Ravi Batra, Southern Methodist University, concerning the impact that free trade is having on our working conditions in this country, and the fact that NAFTA and GATT is something that's being rammed down our throats and to pauperize us, basically. And I was just wondering, it seems that there's so little focus on the left about the issue of doing something about NAFTA and GATT. I was wondering, why is that? Don't you think there ought to be more of a focus to stop, do something about NAFTA and GATT? And
well, I don't.
Because
yeah.
if we can't do anything about that, and I don't see any hope for really mm-hmm. turning the tide against the corporations.
Well, you know, when you say there was no focus on it, that's a little surprising, because that was the major issue for the popular organizations and groupings at the time of NAFTA. In fact, it was such a big, to my amazement, a combination of unions and popular groups and grassroots organizations and so on actually succeeded in putting the issue on the agenda. The intention in NAFTA, remember, was to ram it through without anybody knowing about it. That's another one of those stories that was suppressed. The NAFTA, which is obviously a major story, the NAFTA agreement was signed by the three executives, Canada, United States, and this was Bush, and Mexico, on, I think it was August 12th, 1992. That's right in the middle of a presidential campaign. You know, everybody talking about policy, they signed the NAFTA agreement. Not a peep, you know, nobody knew about it. There's a law in the United States, 1974 trade law, which requires that the Labor Advisory Council, that's a union-based organization, be involved in consultation and advice and, you know, decisions about any trade-related legislation. Well, they weren't informed. Actually, they were informed 24 hours before a deadline to give an opinion. They were told on, I think it was September 15th, like a month later, you have 24 hours, here's the 2,200-page text. They didn't even give them the text. They just said, here, we have a 2,200-page text. Tomorrow is your deadline for giving your opinion about it, so they couldn't even meet. Actually, they did publish quite a good analysis, which was also, none of this was ever reported, nor was their quite good analysis ever reported. And in fact, the idea was that the whole thing would just be rammed through without anybody knowing about it. Well, that didn't quite happen, and it didn't happen precisely because there was a lot of popular agitation, which made it a big issue, and it continued to right through the whole business with the public pretty strongly opposed to NAFTA. I mean, of the part of the public that had an opinion, you know, wasn't a lot of people didn't know about it, but of the people who had an opinion, it was roughly 60% were opposed right through till the end. And that was because of the public agitation and, you know, the labor movement and others. And on GATT, you know, there's been a huge mobilization. 50 years is enough, block GATT, block Change the World Bank, and so on. Of course, it doesn't get any publicity, but it's substantial. Incidentally, as to the consequences of NAFTA, you can get them straight out in the mainstream press, very straight. The day after the NAFTA, and they're very revealing, the day after NAFTA was passed finally, big, you know, the press was 100% in favor of it, in fact, fanatic about it. You know, they were hysterical. This goes all the way over to the left, you know, what's called the left, Anthony Lewis and people. Absolutely hysterical, you know, bitterly attacking labor for what Lewis called its crude, threatening tactics and its, you know, unenlightened attitude because it was opposing this obviously great thing. I didn't see an exception to this. All the way across, maybe you can find one if you look, but it was close to 100% hysterical advocacy, not just advocacy. The day after NAFTA was passed, the New York Times ran its first story on the expected impact in the New York region the day after it was passed. Well, the story was euphoric. It's going to be really terrific. And then they described what would happen. They said that it'll be really great for corporate law firms and investment banks and the publications industry like the New York Times and capital intensive industry like chemical corporations and all the nice people, they'll do fine. Then it said there'll also be some losers, and the losers are women, blacks, Hispanics, and semi-skilled workers, meaning 70% of the workforce. Okay, so women, blacks, Hispanics, and 70% of the workforce, they'll be losers. But, you know, there's always got to be winners and losers. So therefore, it's terrific. It wasn't a secret. Also, this was known in advance. Like, if you read the economists who were advocating NAFTA, like, say, Paul Krugman, who was then at MIT, who were saying it's a great thing, there was always a line there somewhere saying, well, yeah, semi-skilled workers will lose income, like 70% of the workforce. But so it was never really a secret. Of course, in a sense, it was a secret because you really had to be searching to find it, and you had to wait until the day after it was passed to get the New York Times analysis of what it was going to do to the region. But they understood. And the same is always true of Mexico, exactly the same effect on Mexico. There's a lot of talk about, is it good for the United States or is it bad for the United States? And that's just totally meaningless. You know, you have to ask who in the United States and who in Mexico. I mean, it's great for rich people in Mexico. It's great for rich people in the United States, and it's bad for everybody else. But that's the purpose of social policy, after all. And pretty much the same is true of GATT. Incidentally, these things are not free trade agreements. These are investor rights agreements, which are a complicated combination of protection and liberalization. One of the things that the Times, for example, approved of most was the protectionist elements in NAFTA, which they call intellectual property rights, which radically extend protectionism in completely new and unprecedented directions to ensure that the technology of the future will be monopolized by major corporations, and let's say India can't produce cheap drugs for its population and so on. Those are the things they really were enthusiastic about. These are not free trade agreements, this is another kind of story which, like, I would have suggested for them if I had still bothered suggesting stories. I don't.
In Instruments of Statecraft, Michael McClintock has written about the plan for the use of green berets in the United States against a hypothetical communist-led black uprising during the Cold War. With the amount of small arms circulating around the United States with the current economic crisis, there's a significant possibility of the U.S. turning into either the Wild West or Guatemala. Is there a contingency plan or types of legislation for the scenario in the current Congress?
Well, you know, I'm not privy to contingency plans, but we have plenty of leaks. The question was whether there is a possibility of a popular uprising with, you know, people with guns and so on who upset enough in the United States, and are there contingency plans about how to suppress it? That, you know, I have no way of knowing, but it's very likely. In fact, it'd be pretty crazy if it wasn't. And we know some things. Like, for example, there's one of the most, I mean, the Pentagon Papers are, frankly, not terribly interesting, but one, I was involved in them and I wrote a lot about them and so on. There's very little in them that's new, but there were a few things that were new. And one of the things that was new and interesting and is never discussed, I suspect because it's too instructive, is the description of what happened at the very end. Pentagon Papers end around mid-1968. And you recall what was going on right after, this is very exactly what you're talking about, right after the Tet Offensive. The Johnson administration wanted the military to send another 200,000 troops. That would have raised the troop level to around 700,000. And at that point, Wall Street, you know, business, big business, just decided, look, this isn't worth it anymore. And they carried out a very unusual power play, very open and unusual power play. Simply, they sent down a delegation to Washington called the Wise Men, and they basically told Johnson, you know, get lost. It's over. You know, you're not running anymore. Time to wind it down and so on, which is pretty much what happened, more or less. But what about this troop decision? Well, the Pentagon Papers they decided not to send the troops. And the reason was the main reason was the military was strongly opposed because they said they thought they would need the troops for civil disorder control in the United States. They said there's so much opposition to the war among women and young people and, you know, blacks and others, that if any more troops were sent, they simply would have an uprising on their hands, and therefore they had to keep the troops here. You know. Well, that's part of the reason why the war was wound down. You know, they did not want to have to face a war at home, a civil war which could tear apart the society, and I don't know if it would have happened, but that's what they were afraid of. Resistance to the draft, you know, civil disobedience, all sorts of things. And, you know, that's one of the ways in which just, you know, the plain disruption, which was overwhelmingly nonviolent, I should say a lot of it taking place right here in this church, was a factor in limiting the massive destruction. Didn't limit it before they had managed to kill 5 million people approximately, but at least limited it. It wasn't 60 million people. So yeah, I assume the same kinds of plans are around today, and someday maybe we'll find out about them.
Are you familiar with the Harvard Institute for International Development and their work?
Little, yeah.
It's
I work in the mail room there.
Yeah. They try to see if you can liberate some documents. Isn't that where Jeffrey Sachs was just the point? Yeah.
I'm interested in two things. One, what your opinion is of what they're developing. I mean, they do what they call overseas development, economic advising to foreign governments.
Yeah.
What your opinion is of what exactly their version of development is. And secondly, what you know about or what you think about this up-and-coming part of overseas development, which is environmental economics, which is getting especially popular in Eastern Europe.
Well, I wouldn't want to comment on the Institute without looking at in detail at what it's done, but we do know a lot about its new director, Jeffrey Sachs, who became very Harvard economist, who became a big star because he carried out a great achievement in Bolivia. That was his big achievement, and he went on from Bolivia to Poland, where he had another achievement, and then to Russia, where he had another achievement. What he succeeded in doing in Bolivia, and he became a big star, and I assume that's the kind of thing they like and want to do. Well, okay, what happened in Bolivia? Bolivia was a mess, you know, like most of the former colonial world, and Sachs moved in there and fixed it up for him. Bolivia is considered an economic miracle. Actually, it's now under a state of siege, incidentally. Bolivia is one of those economic miracles. If you look at the numbers, the macroeconomic statistics, they look pretty good. You know, like inflation is down, you know, the budget is balanced, all that stuff looks nice. And it was done by the structural adjustment, by standard neoliberal techniques. You get the peasants to produce for the agro-export market and pour in, you know, subsidized U.S. food to replace what they're producing, cut back services, the usual business, and it worked. There's only one little footnote. The peasants are rational, and when they are driven off the farms and stop producing food for local markets because they can't compete with subsidized U.S. agribusiness and told your job is to make money producing for export, you produce what pays, and what pays happens to be coca. So cocaine production shot up. It's now one of the two leading cocaine producers in the world, coca leaf producers in the world. The other one is Peru, where exactly the same thing was done with exactly the same consequences. And as a result of the effect of neoliberal, that's exactly what the bishops were talking about. Remember what I said, what I quoted? I was quoting their talk about the neoliberal economics, which has driven people to the drug market. That's the way it did it. You force people to stop producing for local consumption and to go into the agro-export market and to integrate with international capital, and you produce drugs. So now it's just pouring out of there. People say, you know, Colombia and so on, but there was just a study by the OECD, the rich countries, of the narcotics traffic. And, you know, they don't have exact numbers because it's all technically illegal, but they gave some rough numbers. They estimate about $500 million a year of profit, of which 7% goes to Colombia. That tells you their role. And about over 50% goes to U.S. banks. Okay, that tells you who's involved in the drug racket, and it tells you why the bishops made the statements that I just made. Well, that's the major effect of the policies in Bolivia. What about in Eastern Europe? Well, you want to picture it. I mean, the effect of the policies in Eastern Europe was to destroy the economies. They shot way down. They are turning directly into third world societies with the usual characteristics, including crime. Poland is now one of the main exporters of narcotics, illegal narcotics to Western Europe. Now, Poland had, under the Soviet Union, whatever you think about them, they had developed the societies. This was part of the third world that developed. So they produce more advanced, technically advanced narcotics, you know, amphetamines and stuff like that, not just coca leaves. For the population, it's a complete disaster. There was actually, Harvard Press has a pretty good book that just came out on this. If you want some measure of what happened during those years, not only in Poland but in Russia and the rest, UNESCO put out a study about a year ago estimating just the human cost, simple human cost, like deaths, of the what they call the capitalist reforms, which incidentally UNESCO approved of. And they estimate the, well, for Russia, for example, they estimate about 500,000 extra deaths a year just as a result of the reforms. Poland's a smaller country, so it's a smaller number, but proportional. So sure, these things sort of work in a way. I mean, like if you walk down the streets of Warsaw, you find nice stuff in the shop windows and so on. It's like a third world country. Plenty of wealth, very narrowly concentrated, poverty, starvation, death, huge inequality, and so on. The kind of thing you find when you go to any place that we've had our control of for, you know, 50 years. So yeah, I suppose that's the kind of policies they like, since he's appointed as the head of it. About the environmental economics, I'd be careful, you know. It makes sense if it's done seriously. But the question is how it's done, and you got to look and see how it's done.
Jesse Currier from Brookings for Peace. My question is actually directed to a problem that we have with the media. Recently, some activities here in Boston, such as response to the Chase Manhattan spokesman saying that Batistas have to be eliminated because they're hurting their investments, so we storm the Mexican consulate here, about 60, 70 people. Nothing in the media here, front page Mexico, but more serious was the situation as being an official observer in different countries in Central America. I came back to go to the major newspaper station of newspaper in the city and have photos, facts, information about it. And in the group of reporters, to my face, said, sorry, we can't recruit this, we can't publish this because we'll lose our jobs. I mean, what alternative do we have to deal with mainstream media, or how can we make them responsible or take their job seriously, or, you know, we don't, some kind of answer to that.
Well, first of all, yeah, they are taking their job seriously. It's just that their conception of their job is not your conception of their job. As to how you can influence what they do, you know, there are a lot of ways. First of all, there are people inside the mainstream media, both the Globe and the Herald, who would be sympathetic to what you're doing, some of them fairly high up. But, you know, I don't know, you were there, I wasn't. Most of the time they don't say I'll lose my job, but they know that there are limits that they can't go beyond unless they have public support. Now, the more public support they have, the wider those limits are. And regular, constant pressure on major institutions, that'll even include the Wall Street Journal, will change the spectrum within which they do things. How much it'll change it, you don't know. There's limits, obviously, but it will change it. The other thing that'll change it is alternatives. There's no law of nature that says that there has to be a complete monopoly over information in the hands of huge corporations. That's an institutional fact, not a law of nature. And you don't have to go back very far to see that a much more democratic society. Like in the 1950s, there were, I think, 800 independent labor newspapers, which were reaching about 20 or 30 million people weekly. Well, that was destroyed by concentration of private power, right? But, and that's, you know, that's nowhere near the power of the corporate press, but it's something. The communication networks like radio and television in the United States are a private monopoly, corporate monopoly, but they certainly don't have to be. They aren't in, or they weren't, they're becoming that. But up until now, they haven't been in other societies very much like ours. They're public, you know. And whether these things happen or not depends on, like everything else, on labor rights and, you know, medical insurance and every other thing. It depends on how much functioning democracy there is. How much popular organization, how much activism, how much pressure, how much dismantling of oppressive institutions, and those are choices, you know. It doesn't happen as a gift. You have to fight for it, but you fight for everything.
I wanted to ask a question about the position that the U.S. took during the Cold War. Intellectual criticism, such as your own, was that, well, it's obvious that the U.S. is doing this in corporate interests for corporate reasons or monetary reasons. Of course, the U.S. government wouldn't say, or the executive branch wouldn't say to the population, we're doing this for economic reasons, that's why we're in Vietnam, or we're doing what we're doing in Brazil, or anyplace else in the third world. They essentially said that we're doing it because we're stopping Soviet aggression across the face of the earth. Like, for instance, in every major military conflict, Kennedy or Truman or Johnson read in with go on national television and say this.
Yeah.
Now that the Cold War is over and every major official in the Soviet Union is free to say anything he wants, I was wondering, do you find it odd that nobody in the Soviet Union seems to back the U.S. position?
The U.S., the current U.S. position?
The U.S. position during the Cold War. I'm talking about the executive branch. Like, for instance, one of your favorite documents, NSC 68, was smeared with all kinds of statements about Soviet aggression across the face of Europe. My question is, do you find it odd that now that the Cold War is over, nobody seems to be coming out of the Soviet Union that's in a position to have known what was actually going on, isn't saying anything?
You mean saying we weren't trying to carry out aggression?
Right.
Well, first of all, they don't have to, because one of the nice things, first of all, they're not going to say much, because remember, this is the new third world elite. You go to Brazil, and you go to the, you know, the whatever club the rich bankers hang out in Brazil, they're not going to be criticizing American imperialism. They think it's great. You know, it's terrific for them. It makes them rich. It enables them to crush everybody near them, and so on and so forth. And the ex-nomenclatura, the former leadership of the Communist Party, that's what they are. They're the guys who run the franchises for the Western corporations and, you know, run the crime system and so on. So why should they criticize it? You know, I think it's terrific. But you don't have to go to them, because one of the sort of nice things about the end of the Cold War is that a lot of the pretexts just collapsed. So by now, even if you look at pretty mainstream scholarship, they pretty much concede what was said by the critics all along. But of course, they justify it. In fact, there's what's called a new paradigm in diplomatic history about the Cold War, which everybody adheres to. It has the same bottom line, but that's given. You know, if you're a respectable intellectual, the bottom line is whatever we did, it was right. But you can change the argument that leads to that bottom line. So now the argument's been changed. I mean, nobody pretends anymore nobody's sane, you know, that there was a Soviet aggression was threatened. There's just too much documentary evidence about all this, and they know that they never expected Soviet aggression. So that's sort of given up. But the bottom line stays the same, you know, like Truman was right and NSC 68 was right. But the reason was, and the reason is interesting, the reason was because the United States had to maintain what's called preponderance. Now, preponderance means that we had to guarantee that no matter how far down the line you go, there would never be a threat to the United States. Now, that explains why Acheson was justified in condemning neutralism, you know, what he called the suicide of neutralism. Because if some country was neutral, say India, there's no guarantee that sometime in the future they might not associate themselves with a potential enemy. Right? So therefore, neutralism really is suicide. And in order to maintain preponderance, we really had to run everything. In other words, what mainstream American scholarship, you can read this in journals like International Security, the Harvard Journal, what mainstream American scholarship is now saying, and taking pride in, incidentally, is attributing to the United States exactly what the most extreme hawks attributed to the Soviet Union. That you know, you read Kissinger, they say, well, their concept of security is they're not secure unless they run everything. Well, now the line is we're not secure unless we run everything, and that's right, because we're by definition perfect, and everything we do is correct, so therefore it's right for us to run everything. So it was right for us to have preponderance and to, you know, dominate everything and control everything, even though we now recognize what, of course, obvious, that it wasn't done out of threat of Soviet aggression, because there never was any. In fact, this is even official policy. So, you know, one of the most recent government military, the things that I was quoting before about the technological sophistication of third world powers, which is now the reason for keeping everything the way it always was, also point out that, say, in places like the Middle East, in the 1980s, say, the threat to our interests could not have been laid at the Kremlin's door. So that was all lies, in other words. We now concede that because it's useless, you know. The threat was indigenous nationalism, and we now concede that. In fact, you get a little piece of this in McNamara's ridiculous book that just came out. The line in McNamara's book, and the one that's repeated in all the newspapers, you know, Globe editorials, Times editorials, and so on, is we made a mistake, we underestimated Vietnamese nationalism. And we didn't realize they were nationalists, we thought they were communist hacks. Well, McNamara may actually believe that. He seems to be the book has a kind of ring of sincerity to it. I mean, he seems to be totally ignorant of everything that happened. You know, that was like a millimeter away from his assignment. But if he even knew what was in the Pentagon Papers that he commissioned, he would know that they never underestimated Vietnamese nationalism. They always knew from the very beginning, way back in the 40s, that this was the Vietnamese nationalist movement, and they had to destroy it because it wasn't under control, it was independent. That was always understood, always perfectly well understood. There was never any doubt about it, except on the part of the most extreme imbeciles like Baby McNamara. And it was known all the way through, you know. But the point is, it's now got to be sort of conceded, you know. And in fact, if you look at the, you know, more, I mean, in fact, it's something that's kind of refreshing. You read journals like Foreign Policy. You actually find one of the two main foreign policy journals. There's actually an article in there, which I couldn't really believe when I saw it. It's jointly written by a guy from the RAND Corporation, Benjamin Schwartz, you know, that's the Air Force Research Organization, and Christopher Lane, who's from the Cato Institute, you know, kind of ultra-right institute. And it's a very straight article about American foreign policy. It says, look, let's put aside all the nonsense about defending ourselves from the Russians and so on. Let us simply recognize, as he puts it, that there's a lot of truth to what he calls the Leninist critique of imperialism. Namely, we had to do things to control markets and resources and so on. And of course, we're right to do so because we're perfect. But let's just recognize it, you know. So by now, as I say, the clouds are kind of lifting on those issues. And you don't have to go to the Russians to find it out. We've got plenty of documents here.
I heard you mention before that that prisons and the growth of prisons is a shot in the arm for the economy. And we are seeing a growth in prisons. And everybody, and most people on the left and the right, say, well, yeah, there's more crime. We do need more prisons. Mm. So are we seeing a new role for prisons?
Yeah, absolutely.
What is that role?
Yeah, in fact, very clear new role. As you move towards the third, I mean, remember what a third world society looks like. A third world society has a lot of superfluous people. People are just useless. They have no human rights and no human value because they don't contribute to making profit and enriching the rich. You know, they don't even clean their floors. They're not even needed for anything. In one of our third world domains, that's why we fund security forces. Like half of our military aid, more than half for Latin America, goes to Colombia. And the reason is it has the worst human rights record in the hemisphere. It's slaughtered, the security forces have killed maybe 20,000 people or so in the last few years, you know, political organizers and union leaders and peasants and so on. And that's the way you make sure you keep the superfluous people under control. You slaughter them. Well, we haven't quite reached that level here, though we're getting to be a third world society. So what we do with the superfluous people, the ones who don't contribute to wealth production for the rich, and therefore aren't human, really, what you do with them is, first of all, try to coop them up in slums, which are sort of like concentration camps. And if that doesn't work, you put them in jail, which is the equivalent, sort of the counterpart in a wealthy society to death squads in a poor society. And so they're naturally zooming. And they are a shot in the arm. Incidentally, crime is not going up, at least as far as any evidence is concerned. I mean, if you can believe the government, you know, FBI statistics and all this other stuff, crime is fairly level, you know. I mean, it sort of went up in the 70s. Since then, according to them, it's even declined. But the perception of crime has increased, but that's because it's not that it's not a serious problem, especially if you're a poor person. It's an extremely serious problem because crime is mostly poor people preying on each other. So you're a poor person, you know, living down in Roxbury, yeah, crime's a problem, but they're not the ones who are calling for more prisons, you know, to put, you know, their own sons in jail. In fact, there are now more black males in the prison system than in the education system in the, you know, relevant ages. In fact, what the criminal system is simply being used as a war against, literally a war against an unwanted part of the population. A part of the population that used to be industrial workers, or at least have the opportunity to, and maybe work themselves up, but now just have no rights, because you don't need that anymore. You can get them cheaper somewhere else. So you got to get rid of them. That's a large part of what the drug war is about. The drug war has no effect on drugs. In fact, as I mentioned, a large part of, and it's well known outside the United States, as in the Bishop's statement, that a large part of the drug policies are fomenting the production of drugs. And in fact, if anybody wanted to do something about the drugs, they'd go to wherever those $260 billion of annual profits are being laundered, namely U.S. banks. You know, you don't see many bankers in jail. The drug program is designed and implemented to criminalize an unwanted population, black males, Hispanic males, and so on. So, you know, you take a look at the chain gangs in Alabama, and it'll be somebody who had a joint in his pocket, you know, that sort of thing. So that's what you do with it. As for the system has a side benefit. It's state spending, so it has a stimulative effect on the economy. Firms like, say, Merrill Lynch, you know, and Prudential and so on, they are putting out bonds, tax-free bonds, for the building of prisons and making a lot of money on it. It's a growth. It's part of the growth system. You know, it's not the scale of the Pentagon, but it's sort of, you know, got the same function. In fact, the military corporations are all, like Lockheed and so on. They're already realizing it, so they are now exploring the possibility of entering on, you know, climbing on that gravy train, and developing high tech methods of surveillance and control, which the public will pay for, and it'll be dual-use technology, and you'll be able to use it for something else. Actually, there was a big story in the Wall Street Journal about it a couple months ago. So, you know, you're a good engineer. You can figure out a way to implant an electrode in somebody, so then some supercomputer somewhere will have them under surveillance, and if they go the wrong place, you send out a shock or, you know, drug, you know, chemicals or something or other. And that way you could have very efficient monitoring of and control of large parts of the population, which would be quite cost effective, except of course for the technology, which the public is paying for anyway. Prison construction alone is a booming industry, and the security personnel has been, maybe still is, the fastest growing white collar operation for some profession for some years. So all of this stuff goes on with, you know, pouring money into the hands of the wealthier sectors, Merrill Lynch, construction. Also, the prisons are being privatized. I don't remember the figures, but the growth of the privately run prisons is far higher than the state-run prisons. And that's just another scam. Privatized prisons is like privatized health. It means the public pays the costs in one or another technique, but there's private profit, and you have a lot of techniques of, you know, you can cut down costs by putting more prisoners into a cell, and you don't have to give them any care and no rehabilitation, none of that stuff. So I think the whole thing is a very natural consequence of the policies designed to create a third world type society. Now, when I say third world, I don't mean the United States is going to look like Mexico, you know, much too rich for that. But it's going to that structure, you know, that kind of structure at a richer level. And yeah, that's prisons are a part of that, just as death squads and the terror of the security forces is part of Mexico and Colombia.
You mentioned earlier in your talk the angry white man syndrome. I know I'm going to take some heat for this, but isn't there some benefit to these type of people experiencing the same kind of repression that people of color and women have experienced throughout the history of this country? Because then they get a chance to, instead of point the finger at the victim, get a chance to point the finger at themselves. The second question is, can you give your opinion about affirmative action, the recent attacks on it?
Well, first of all, you know, when you say that they have to feel that oppression, that kind of suggests that they haven't felt it in the past, which just isn't true. If you go back, let's go back 100 years, when the big immigration was coming in from, well, when the immigration was, let's take Boston. When the Irish immigration was coming in here, Irish were being treated like blacks. You know, in fact, if you read the writings of fancy, Cambridge intellectuals 100 years ago, like Charles Francis Adams, he was warning that pretty soon, if we didn't watch out, we were going to have a Celtic proletariat on the east and a Chinese proletariat in the west, and you know, our great Anglo-Saxon civilization would collapse, and so on. They were just like blacks. Okay, and treated like blacks, right here in Boston, in fact, for a long time. You don't have to go very far from here. You know, say go to Western Pennsylvania, where the big steel, where Andrew Carnegie was building his billion-dollar corporation with federal aid. There were some black workers, but the ones who were worst treated were what they called the Huns. Huns meant sort of anybody from Eastern Europe. You know, And they were Untermenschen, you know, real slime, and you got to smash them and so on. In fact, it was only the organization of the labor movement that brought people together. Exactly is what happened with blacks, incidentally. I mean, during the period of formation of the CIO, the color lines were either blurred or eliminated in common struggle for something else. And the same thing had happened for Irish, for, you know, Eastern Europeans and so on. Now, you're right when you say the treatment of blacks was always worse. I mean, at whatever level you mention it, treatment of the blacks was always worse for perfectly obvious reasons. They were the only enslaved population. So, yes, it was always a cut below. But the answer to this isn't to make, you know, the Irish and the, you know, and the Huns and the rest of them suffer like blacks. The answer is the answer that was given during the formation of the labor movement at Homestead, Pennsylvania in 1892 and the, you know, little steel strike in the late 30s and so on, and that is to break down the color lines because you're fighting a different struggle. Instead of, we have a one-sided class war going on. There's one sector of the United States that's really deeply Marxist fanatics. They are fighting, they're very vulgar Marxists. You read their literature, it reads like Maoist texts with just the words inverted. They're always fighting a bitter class war, and they never stop. They have plenty of resources, and they got people to do it for them, and they put billions of dollars a year into propaganda and so on. And if they're the only ones who are fighting it, you know exactly how it's going to turn out. If the the other 90% of the population get into the act, it can turn out differently. And that's the answer, not making these guys in Michigan suffer like blacks. Because that's just going to lead them to Nazism. You know, we've seen where that goes. I mean, that's the ground, you know, that's a groundswell that could lead to American Nazism. In fact, it's the most likely outcome, something like that. Oh, affirmative action. Well, you know, this was a method for trying to overcome some of the extreme inequities for women and for blacks. And, of course, in a period when you're trying to extend inequities and to make the society even more unequal and to concentrate wealth and power even more narrowly, obviously that's going to be under attack. So it's just part of the general attack on a commitment to some sort of, not even equality, just, you know, rights for people. When you attack rights, you're also going to want to attack access to rights. So it just follows. And we ought to be defending it for the same reason we defend rights.
With all of your cynicism, where do you find your hope?
Well, you know, it's I don't know exactly how much hope I have, but whatever hope there is exactly where it's always been. I mean, there have been worse periods. So if you go back to, let's say during the early part of this century, what's happening in Decatur, Illinois. It's pretty ugly. I mean, they may succeed in destroying the last part of the industrial workforce. On the other hand, look at what happened, say, up until 1935. I mean, you know, nobody knows how many because nobody counted, but at least 700 American workers were simply murdered by the security forces. During the period of labor struggles in the United States to try to gain just an eight-hour day. That's why May Day is celebrated all around the world as a day of solidarity with American workers. In fact, you go to the right-wing British press in the, like the London Times in the 1920s and so on, they were just appalled at the treatment of American workers. I mean, American workers were getting murdered straight out by the security forces into the late 1930s, you know, right through the Roosevelt period. So, you know, things have looked bad plenty of times. And there has been recovery by popular struggle. In the 1920s, it looked as if the labor movement and independent thought and so on had been totally smashed. It was worse than now. It looked like there was complete euphoria after the Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare, which smashed up the unions and, you know, kicked out 4,000 people from the country and put the leading labor leader, Eugene Debs, into jail for 10 years and so on and so forth. And the business community, and they were supported by elite opinion, including liberal elite opinion, I should say, and it looked as if they'd won. You know, they were terribly surprised when the Depression came and turned out they hadn't won. So, you know, what hope is there? Well, you know, things change. So, in fact, in many ways, the country is a lot better even now than it was 30 years ago. You wouldn't have this many people 30 years ago listening to talks on topics like this. In fact, you wouldn't have four people, and I know that very well, you know, having been involved in giving talks to four people in churches not very long ago, you know, 30 years ago. So things change, but they sometimes change for the better. But it doesn't, you know, like it doesn't happen by itself. I mean, it changed from the 1960s because an awful lot of people dedicated themselves to it.
I had a question about the latest trade fight in Japan. I read about, I think, 3 or 4 years ago in the Boston Globe, they had a section in the, a piece in the business section about the trade barriers to U.S. cars and parts going over there. And what I recall it saying was that there was virtually nothing. It was pretty much an open market, and the U.S. didn't sell right-hand drive models, and they were too big, and all that, and there was a problem. So I was just wondering what's behind this sort of latest spat between the U.S. and Japan, and what's causing it?
Well, you know, neither the United States or Japan believes in a free market, of course. We have all sorts of free interferences with markets here. As I mentioned, in the 1980s, the Japanese and, you know, the South Koreans and Taiwanese would have just wiped out American industrial production if we'd opened up our markets. So therefore, we closed our markets. That's the 1980s, not long ago. The Japanese have their own systems for controlling, you know, for supporting domestic producers and so on. And the United States wants to very selectively break down barriers while keeping other barriers. The real question you should be asking yourself is, in whose interest is this being done? For example, will there be an effect? Suppose that they manage to sell more American. Suppose that this battering ram, which is in violation of GATT rules and is condemned around the world, I should say, suppose that it succeeds in breaking open the Japanese market. Who's going to gain? Like, will American workers gain? No. American corporations have already told us the answer to that one. Again, read the Wall Street Journal, you know, yesterday, a couple of days, within the last couple of days. There was an article in which the parts manufacturers in the United States pointed out that if they get greater access to Japanese markets, they'll be delighted because their profits will go up, but they're going to supply them from overseas production, which makes perfect sense if you think about it. You know, like if you're a manufacturer based in Boston, and you have to supply Japanese markets, it makes a lot more sense to supply them from super cheap labor in China or Indonesia than from Decatur, Illinois. So that's what they're going to do. So the results of opening up the Japanese markets, and it's a battering ram in violation of GATT rules, nobody doubts that. If it works, it will improve the profit ratings for some U.S.-based corporations, but it's not going to have a no effect or maybe a harmful effect for American workers. Because these things are not United States versus Japan. That's mythology. It's a sector of the United States and a sector of Japan versus another sector of the United States and another sector of Japan. That's the way it always is, and that's the way it is here.
I'm hoping you can comment a little bit more on this, the myth of nationalism in a sense. With the rise in transnational companies and with agreements like GATT and NAFTA and the EEC coming together, why does popular nationalism tend to mirror official nationalism that's put out by, say, the heads of state? Is there any hope for popular nationalism helping the labor movement?
There's no simple answer. First of all, nationalism has always been a myth, and it was recognized to be a myth centuries ago. I mean, you can read about it in Adam Smith, you know, he wrote a book, as everybody knows, called Wealth of Nations, but he also pointed out that it's nonsense. You know, there's no such notion. That the policies that are, he was speaking mostly about England, and he said, look, the policies that are carried out in England of the English government are determined by what he called the principal architects, who in his day were the merchants and manufacturers of England, and he said they didn't use state power to enrich themselves, to ensure that their own interests are most peculiarly attended to, as he put it, however grievous the impact on the people of England. So in other words, it's a class policy. I mean, yes, the nation is mobilized, but in class interests, the interests of the people who own the society. Well, you know, what was obvious to Adam Smith ought to be obvious to us. And it would be if we didn't have it beaten out of our heads, because it's a truism. You know, I mean, a 10-year-old would be able to figure it out if they just thought about the world for a second. So it takes, again, a good education to drive these things out of your head. But it's obviously true what Adam Smith regarded. He didn't make a big fuss about this because it's so obviously true, he just mentioned it. But it was obviously true then. It's much more obviously true now for exactly the reason you mentioned. I mean, since the 1970s, there's been a considerable acceleration of the internationalization of the economy. How considerable, you can argue. It's not so obvious, really, when you compare it with, say, a century ago or two centuries ago. But yes, it's gone up. So, like, when you have corporate headquarters in, you know, Boston, and production facilities in Indonesia, and you know, banks offshore in the Cayman Islands, so you can launder drugs without any drug money without anybody bothering you, and the rest of it, then of course the concept of national entity erodes, and you can see it in the figures. For example, you know, we're supposed to have a big trade deficit, right? One of our big problems is this twin deficit, one of them being the trade deficit. And it's true, if you take a look at the U.S. borders and you look at the stuff that goes across the borders, there's a trade deficit. On the other hand, the Commerce Department recently recalculated the trade deficit under a proposal by the National Academy of Sciences, and they calculated it so as to take production exports by U.S.-based corporations overseas were counted part of our positive, part of our exports. And, you know, imports would be, say, if they imported capital goods from somewhere. Well, it turned out that we now have a big trade, positive trade balance. And the business press, like the Wall Street Journal, pointed out that's the right way to do it. Because the United States, from their point of view of their constituency, doesn't mean the geographical borders. It means the rich guys in the United States. And for them, there's a positive trade balance. For the country, there's a negative trade balance. And in fact, what's called trade isn't trade anyway, because about 40% or so of U.S. trade is actually internal to corporations, so it isn't even trade. You know, it's just moving things around across borders within a corporation centrally controlled. So sure, if you really did an honest analysis of the international economy, you wouldn't use notions like nation or trade or any of these things, because they're all pretty deceitful. But it's true that populations are mobilized in support of the interests of the principal architects of policy who own the societies constantly. That's why countries go to war, you know. Or that's why they follow destructive domestic policies. And, you know, constructive nationalism can react against that. It can, in fact, it doesn't have to be hostile to other nationalisms. It can be cooperative with it. You know, if people do fall together in one or another kind of grouping, there's nothing wrong with that. There's no reason why one or another of those groupings has to be hostile to another one. They can recognize that there are interests that cut across them, and they can try to cooperate with those who have the same interests within another grouping, another nationality, you know, for common, like American workers and Mexican workers have basically the same interests. They can both work within their national entities, you know, to develop policies which will be cooperative and supportive. The other side of the class war. I mean, there's nothing good or bad about nationalism. It depends how it's used.